The Connecticut General Assembly's Committee on Children called a hearing on Wednesday to discuss recent reports about conditions at the state's two juvenile detention facilities, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School for Boys and the Pueblo Unit for Girls. Both are run by the State Department of Children and Families. The report found that young people in each facility were subjected to repeated and unlawful restraint and isolation. Professor Robert Kinscherf wrote one of the reports. He's with the National Center for Mental Health and Juvenile Justice, and he was contracted by the DCF to do the study. He also testified at Wednesday's hearing. Professor Kinscherf joins us from his offices at William James College in Newton, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
How did you first get involved with the Connecticut DCF?
I was first involved over a decade ago following an incident at the Connecticut Juvenile Training School, and there was a period of consultation at that time. But more recently, I began a consultation process in December 2014 at the request of DCF Commissioner Joette Katz.
And if we could go back to that 2004 involvement that you had with DCF, I understand you conducted your first investigation just after there had been a riot at the Connecticut Juvenile Training School. At the time, did you call for that facility to be shut down?
Yes, at the time I thought that the facility itself was problematic, but also that there was a very traditional juvenile incarceration approach that would be difficult to rectify.
After your most recent study, did your opinion change about shutting down that facility?
It has changed to the extent to which I think there has been tremendous organizational change since 2004, and there have been new efforts to bring the juvenile training school into a more progressive and effective model to help stabilize children in shorter lengths of stay, to identify and meet their needs, and to return them back in relatively short periods of time to reengage with what should be the primary site of intervention with juvenile delinquents whenever possible, which is community-based services.
Can you tell us a bit about who these kids are?
Well, most of the children involved in the juvenile justice system with some degree of contact in Connecticut, that's about 11,000 children at any given point. The majority of those children are served under the supervision of the court through the Court Support Services Division. Those are youth who are largely still at home or in other community-based settings and on probation. About 3% of those youth end up getting committed to the Department of Children and Families. And of those youth, a very small number of them, about 0.75 of the total number of youth who are involved in juvenile justice in Connecticut end up at the Pueblo Unit or the training school. These are youth who have been committed by the courts because of their failure to respond to community-based supervision, and they are often committed for a period of time to the Connecticut training school or the Pueblo Unit, where in turn they are stabilized and effort is made to put them back out into community-based services as soon as possible. They tend to be youth who are either new to the facilities. About 70% of the kids who came into the Connecticut Juvenile Training School last year were previously unknown to the facility or to DCF. And they tend to be youth who have failed out of somewhere between 3 to 6 efforts at community-based services before coming to the facility on a new commit or a reentry.
And what about the children who wind up restrained or put in isolation for one reason or another? Who are they?
They tend to fall into a couple of different groups. One group of youth who in the first week or months or so of a stay, which at this point the target date for a discharge is 6 months. So these are kids who come in, they've been having trouble on the streets, in the community, in their families. They often have conflicts with kids who may already be there. And in the first period of time that they're there, they may require a restraint. They tend to account for most of the restraints. A fairly small number of youth account for a disproportionate number of restraints, and these are youth who often have pretty significant emotional disturbance, very significant trauma histories, sometimes pretty significant mental health needs.
I understand the intention at the hearing yesterday was to play some tapes of things that were going on at these facilities, but for technical reasons, that couldn't happen. I understand you've seen the tapes. Can you tell us something about what's on them?
I'm not sure that I've seen all the tapes. I have seen tapes that were sent to me to be reviewed by the Office of the Child Advocate, and these are tapes which show youth, at least in the time frame of the clip, that show youth who are being restrained or secluded, who, at least at that point in the process, did not appear to be presenting with an immediate threat to themselves or others, or where the seclusion in particular had gone on for some hours to days. And I think those are of concern, and I have been working with the leadership at DCF and in the facility to set up a mechanism to identify and review those situations, because we don't want to overuse or misuse restraint or seclusion.
What does being restrained look like?
Well, to be honest with you, it's not a pretty sight. It involves physical management of a youth, and sometimes youth are compliant with the effort to restrain them, and sometimes they're not. And so it may require adults to vigorously hold on to them. And this can be dangerous for the staff. It can be dangerous for the youth. Restraints should be used as a last resort when efforts to de-escalate a situation have failed. One positive step that the DCF has taken at the training school in the wake of these reports has been to kind of bring a two-year process of retraining their staff to fruition by eliminating the use of prone restraints, which are face-down restraints. Prone restraints are particularly dangerous because of the possibility of compressing lungs and otherwise injuring both staff and the child. So I think that's one very positive step that has come from this review.
The DCF officials at the hearing spoke about the quality of the different programs available at the Connecticut Juvenile Training School for Boys. How good is that programming?
Well, let me take those one at a time. I think the educational programming is quite superb. Many of the youth who come to the training school have not been in school. They've been truant. They are lagging behind academically. Many of them are 2 to 4 years behind in reading level, for example. And the school programming there has been very good at catching youth up, and I'm particularly mindful of helping youth achieve literacy skills, because literacy skills is a powerful protective factor in helping youth leave adolescent delinquency behind and not penetrating the adult criminal justice system. They also have been able to graduate a number of youth. I think last year, 43 youth earned their high school diplomas while they were there. They also have a fairly extensive vocational training program that allows youth to begin acquiring job skills in everything from carpentry to computer graphics. And I think this is a wise use of resources as well, since having employable skills is a very powerful protective factor against adult criminal misconduct. The clinical services available are also robust. Each youth that comes in has a 30-day assessment period that is very detailed. I think there are measures that can be taken to allow for a more assertive and coherent model of clinical care, and to be substantially more trauma-informed in the clinical approaches, and to support a trauma-informed approach to care throughout the facility.
You mentioned in your report that community-based mental health providers seem to be reluctant to work with young people in the juvenile justice system, and that African-American boys specifically were difficult to get accepted by providers. Why is that?
I just want to be clear about what I had reported. That was not a finding on my part. I did not do an investigation of the patterns of community-based utilization, since my task was to focus on the training school and the Pueblo unit. It is a significant enough issue, however, that when I heard about this perception from collateral contacts who work within the community system and are more familiar with it, I thought it was important to pass on so that data could be collected to see if, in fact, that is the case.
At the hearing, you did mention that DCF needs better case histories for the young people who are entering these facilities. You said it could help determine what type of therapies they might benefit from. How would better data sharing across agencies help these kids?
Well, in the short term, it would help us to respond to their needs when they first come into the facility. For example, many of these youth, before coming to the training school, will have spent some time in detention units that are operated by Court Support Services Division. It would be useful to know before a youth arrives at the DCF hardware secure facilities whether or not this child has had a difficult time inside of detention. And that's just what would be most useful to know in the first hours or days of a child arriving. If we also had more extensive histories about their educational and clinical services in the past, that would help us to refine our assessments and to help people more readily identify and meet the needs that they've got educationally and clinically.
The Department of Children and Families did say it's committed to providing therapeutic programs to rehabilitate youth. Your report and the Child Advocate report both say, though, that there's tension in the juvenile justice system between using therapy or incarceration to rehabilitate these kids. Can you determine or could you determine what is causing this tension?
Well, I think it's a tension between two different approaches. And part of what we are watching in the development of the CJTS and the Pueblo unit is a shift in perspective from a much more traditional model of juvenile justice, especially in juvenile incarceration settings, where the emphasis, quite frankly, was on compliance and simply getting children to behave in very particular ways and punishing them for failing to do so was thought to deter them from misbehavior when they went back into the community. Unfortunately, the research suggests that it's quite the opposite. The longer you keep youth in hardware-secure facilities and out of the community, and the more punitively you deal with them, the more likely you are actually to increase rather than to drop the recidivism rate. A more research-based approach now is to front-load your resources into community-based interventions, which DCF has done in recent years, and to try and limit exposure to facilities-based care. And while they are there, instead of relying upon a traditional correctional model, to really rely on principles of youth engagement and family engagement, and to use trauma-informed care and educational and special educational approaches in order to stabilize them so that they can return back to their communities.
Do you think these two facilities, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School for Boys, the Pueblo Unit for Girls, do you think they're on track to be shut down?
I don't know whether or not they're on track to be shut down. I know that there has been a great deal of effort to try and move from this more traditional correctional model to a more rehabilitative one. I know that instead of youth going into these facilities for months to years, the target discharge now is for most youth 6 months or less. The census has been drawn down from over 100, and at some points in its history, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School had 200 youth or more. As of this week, the census is 70. So I think the jury is out on whether or not the facilities will be able to achieve their goals of rapidly stabilizing youth while reducing recidivism when they're released back into the facility. It is certainly the case that very large, high census, traditional juvenile correctional facilities simply don't work. In fact, they make the problem worse. As the census is drawn down and as lengths of stay go down, And as there is a more service-oriented and trauma-informed model, I guess we'll have to let the data tell us whether or not there's been enough change at these facilities to warrant the continued investment.
Professor Kinsherf, thanks for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Professor Robert Kinsherf is with the National Center for Mental Health and Juvenile Justice. He is the author of one of two recent reports about conditions at Connecticut's two juvenile detention facilities.